Welcome to I'm Obsessed With This, the Netflix podcast about the shows and films viewers cannot get enough of. Today I'm joined via satellite, via phone, via FaceTime audio by pop culture writer and author of the new book, The Way We Became the Brady Bunch. It's hard to say that without being like lyrical about it. The Way We Became the Brady Bunch, Kim Potts. Hi Kim, how are you?
Hi Bubby, I'm good. It's so good to talk to you.
I know, it's great to talk to you too. You're dealing okay during this quarantine?
Netflix is a big part of that, of course. But yes, we do have no lack of great things to watch and great things to read, and great people to talk to. So I think if we remember those things, we'll get through this, even if we are still in our apartments in July.
In July, or August, or September, October.
Okay, we can only take that joke so far. Thank God there's so much good TV to watch and so many good books to read.
And podcasts to listen to, like you said.
Podcasts to listen to, so many great ones.
Yeah, so I think that's a great way of introducing your book, The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch, How the Canceled Sitcom Became the Beloved Pop Culture Icon We Are Still Talking About Today. We are still talking about today, thanks in part to this book and also the Property Brothers.
Yes.
And HGTV, who brought that house back.
Oh, that was such a great series.
So can you tell me about your history with the show? When you first started watching it, when the idea for the book kind of came to you, what is Kim's relationship with the Brady Bunch?
I mean, I watched it like as a young kid in the late 70s, early 80s syndication airings. And then when it was on TBS and it was on TV Land and all those things, and watched it with my cousins and watched it with friends in college later on. So it was always, I always liked the show. But it really came about as a book idea for me when I had noticed that the 50th anniversary of the show was coming up, which happened last fall. And I started just kind of, you go, oh, that's interesting. Can't, you know, 50 years, that's kind of amazing that it's still, you know, in the popular culture. But then I started kind of digging a little deeper and realized just how much it's continued to be a part of our popular culture. It's had several spinoff series and the big screen movie in the 90s. And then, I mean, it's been, there have been books, the cast members have written books. It's been a Weird Al song parody. I mean, just every area of pop culture that you can think of, both The Simpsons and Family Guy have spoofed it or referenced it dozens of times in episodes. It really, you know, really has just gone, swept across every area of pop culture. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the HGTV series, but it also really has a genuine place in TV and pop culture history. Not that many shows can say they're still that popular 50 years later, and people still love that cast and the characters, and they're still quoting my nose, my nose, my nose, and pork chops and applesauce and all those things. Mm-hmm. So I really felt like it deserved a book length examination of why it's been so popular or why it continues to be what it means to people, and just kind of a chronicle of all the ways that it does continue in pop culture.
Yeah, and it's one of those artifacts that remains really influential and I don't know, persistent, despite the fact that I'm sure a lot of the people who know about it have not seen an episode of it. Like, it just persists in culture without the burden of having to watch it also.
It's so
sort of fascinating.
Well, like you said, with the just saying the title of the book, you want to sing it because you think of that theme song. And there are people who know the theme song, but as you said, have never seen an episode of the show. I think there were people probably who watched the HGTV renovation series of the house and didn't necessarily, you know, hadn't necessarily seen an episode of the show. So yeah, it really is that pervasive and still that influential.
Of course, I don't know any details, but what HGTV did release was that the ratings for that show were sort of through the roof. And it stands to reason, if that many people watched it, some people have not watched The Brady Bunch before, you know?
Right, exactly.
It can't all be Brady Bunch viewers.
Right, that's true. I mean, I think there were probably a lot of Property Brothers fans, mm-hmm. and they wanted to see, you know, what were those brothers getting up to now? but it was a fun show to watch just from that aspect of it, you know, completely remodeling this house to make it look like a TV house is just kind of a fun idea. And you kind of think about some other shows that they could do that with, like the Happenings house, or, you know, a ton of other houses they could do that with. But it was a really fun show. And I think what the other thing that was really nice for the cast of the Brady Bunch and for fans, especially longtime fans, that it really did kind of bring to the fore how much affection people really do have for the show. And, you know, it's kind of dismissed sometimes as this very silly little family sitcom from the mm-hmm. you know, late 60s, early 70s, but it does still mean a lot to a lot of people. And that's sweet. And it's sweet that, you know, that they had this chance to catch up with the cast and see what they still, you know, what they look like now and if they get along and all those things that you got a little glimpse at on the show. It was kind of fun to do that, mm-hmm. I think, for fans especially.
Yeah. Everyone who's interested in TV, or I guess specifically TV history, should definitely go out, buy your book, read it. But I want to focus on a couple chapters right now because we have a lot of other stuff to get to. But yes. Let's start at the beginning. You hear the dun 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 whenever I say that. But the first chapter is called A Hunch About the Bunch, and in it, it's literally the opening paragraph of the book. You describe how Sherwood Schwartz, the creator, got the idea for the show in 1966 because he read an article about how 29% of all marriages include a child from a previous marriage, and it mm-hmm. made me think about the headlines dominating today's papers. Yes. And do you think our current cultural landscape is going to be, just because there's so much going on, do you mm-hmm. think it's going to be a boon for TV creators kind of once the wheels of Hollywood start fully churning again?
I do, but I also think that all of the new streaming the existing streaming services and the new streaming services that are coming about in the next few months, if those launches are still going to happen on time, mm-hmm. I think that it's really shown that people have deep, deep affections for older shows. I mean, think on Netflix, I certainly go to The Office. I don't even know how many times I've seen each episode of The Office. I'm going to say at least 6 or 7 each episode. but I go to that whenever sometimes I'm eating lunch or, you know, I'm taking a quick break. I just want like something soothing. I just want to laugh. And I know exact scenes that will make me do that. I know exactly. I just listened to your, episode on Schitt's Creek, which I also mm-hmm. am obsessed with.
Love Schitt's Creek.
And love Schitt's Creek. There is an episode that I love, and it is my go-to feel-good episode, the Olive Branch episode where David he serenades.
Oh, yes.
You know, and I mm-hmm. love that scene so much, and I can just go to that, and it automatically soothes me. And I think that's this situation that we're in right now, I think, is definitely bringing that out, that people go to TV. It is a soothing thing for a lot of people. Everybody has their favorites and their, you know, their specific scenes, their specific episodes that they love in their favorite shows. So I think if anything, that's what's going to kind of become even clearer from our quarantines right now. I do think people are going to, I hope that creative people have the time right now that they're thinking about even more shows, even new shows. Although, yeah. Again, it does not feel like there is a lack of new shows for us to watch right now.
Exactly. And The Brady Bunch is streaming in its entirety right now on Hulu, I believe. Mm-hmm. So
yes,
there's an abundance of shows sort of that people are nostalgic for that you cannot revisit. Even though we think that all these things are so easily accessible, there are a lot of blind spots and black holes. And it says something that Brady Bunch is one of the ones that you can very easily watch if you want to.
It's true. I mean, I think about a couple of shows from when I was a kid, the original One Day at a Time. Mm-hmm. Alice was a show that I loved when I was a little kid. And, you know, some of those things, yeah, there are still some blind spots there.
Right. I guess the last thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of the Brady Bunch, this realization sort of happened during a very Brady renovation when I was watching it, which you also mentioned in the book. But when you see the numbers in black and white, it sort of is shocking. And you said, for 50 years, more than 75% of their lives, the Brady Bunch actors have been famous for being Greg, Marsha, Peter, Jan, Bobby, and Cindy Brady. That's just almost absurd to think about. And especially on a very Brady renovation where you see them mm-hmm. and they're all sort of fine. We have this idea in our heads that child stars are almost certainly going to be doomed to failure or doomed to tragedy. And here they were on a very brand new renovation, participating and looking great. And
yes,
it's so bizarre that they have been children in our collective memories for 50 years. I guess I just hadn't really realized how old the show is.
It's true. I mean, it is, as you said, when you see the numbers and you in that context specifically, and then you saw them on recently, you know, last fall, it was pretty mind blowing. And, you know, and it's such a, they have all have a very complicated relationship with the show. They were very popular as kids. They were in the teen magazines, on the covers of teen magazines. And they thought that when the show ended, they were going to go right into, you know, continuing their show business career. That didn't necessarily happen for most of them, definitely not at the level they expected. So, and then for the next 50 years, you know, they had to live with this whether they wanted to or not, but they weren't necessarily getting benefits from it. You know, for some of them, they decided to just abandon a showbiz career altogether at various points and had whole new careers and were mostly very successful with them. Again, and that's, I, for me, that's what made it very sweet to see kind of the outpouring of love and appreciation that they got when the HGTV series aired. I think it was a surprise to a lot of them because, you know, they, again, the show has been dismissed a lot as being kind of this frivolous little sitcom, family sitcom. And it prevent, you know, they were typecast a lot and they couldn't always get other work. And so to have that, you know, very complicated history with the show, and then at this point in their lives, to get such an outpouring of fan support and love for the show, I think they were touched. You could see, I think, on the show at points they were very touched by the whole project.
Yeah, and it's, and it must have been a nice coda for you as like the author of the book to like get this, in a way, happy ending that these kids are in a good place and they're still remembered fondly by people and they can still, the Brady Bunch is still sort of alive and well in American hearts in a way.
And I think that's absolutely true. I mean, they are just a huge slice of Americana, of American pop culture, of American TV history. And it was a great way to kind of see that part of the anniversary celebrated. And they all now kind of have embraced social media and they're doing other projects with HGTV. And I think they're all, it's kind of hush hush, but there's a new Brady something in the works. No one can really talk about what that might be yet, but I think there are discussions happening about it. And yeah, it's cool. Also, I mean, who doesn't love like a comeback story or in their case, a continuation story? You know, I think that in and of itself is such an American thing, such an American story.
Yeah, it's really heartwarming. But now I guess we're going to talk about the opposite of that. There is a way to transition into chatting about The Pharmacist sort of gracefully from The Brady Bunch, because I feel like one of the hooks of The Pharmacist is introducing the pharmacist, Dan Schneider's family, as a sort of happy Brady Bunch-like family, this all-American family. I guess they compare themselves to the Griswolds, but I don't think comparing themselves to the Bradys is all that ridiculous. But then you watch the whole thing disintegrate, and you see how these perfect things are never really perfect, and how perfection can never last, and they are usually masking something a lot sadder. But how did you find The Pharmacist? I did not watch it until you said that's what you wanted to watch.
Maybe I had seen like a little preview story on it, and then I just saw it on, and it was on Netflix, and for something else, and saw it and did not intend to watch all of it, intended to just kind of check it out. And it was a Saturday, and cut to me Saturday night, and I've watched the whole thing. I mean, that's, you know, the story of Netflix, right? But it was kind of accidental. I had seen the story and knew that I was going to watch it at some point. But then when I was there on the site and saw it and nothing, or maybe I was procrastinating something, but whatever, I had the time to kind of delve into it, and I did, and couldn't stop when that first episode absolutely hooks you, and you know, you're hooked for the whole series then.
Yeah. And I watched it truly blind, which feels very rare in this day and age. I saw that it was 4 episodes and I said, okay, maybe I can finish it this morning. And I did. I finished it in one morning, or one morning, then an afternoon, because it kept evolving and turning into something entirely different. I almost want to tell people not to listen to this if they haven't watched the episode, because the surprises of it are, and it feels weird to call, you know, human tragedy like surprising and twisty, but it really is. And just to see the story unfold is really shocking, because it begins as this story about a friendly neighborhood pharmacist who is trying to solve the murder of his son. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes a story about addiction, and then it becomes a story about someone who's trying to address addiction, and then it becomes a larger story about, you know, widespread addiction and the opioid crisis and corporate corruption and just like evil corporations who are profiting off death and, you know, the nightmares of the American people. What is your existing relationship to true crime? Is this a genre you're already familiar with and something that you are predisposed to enjoy?
Totally. And that definitely factored into me watching it and getting hooked on it so quickly. I love true crime stories. I there are a ton of series, ID and Oxygen Network do all of those different series. And I do watch, you know, a fair number of them. But when it's a docuseries, a 4-part Netflix docuseries, I immediately assume it's going to be great. Yeah. And, the other, you mentioned, like, should we maybe tell people, don't listen to this until you've watched it? It's so funny, because usually one of my first reactions when I'm watching anything true crime that really draws you in, I want to immediately start Googling, you know, like the behind the scenes, the facts, and what have they changed maybe for, you know, the docuseries, what have they changed from the actual story? And I also immediately, if there are characters that you really start to have affection for, you want to look up and see, where are they now? Are they okay? And that absolutely happened with this one, when Dan Schneider, the pharmacist in this small town near New Orleans, starts investigating the murder of his son, Danny Jr., and he starts putting himself in some very dangerous situations, and people keep telling him that he's putting himself in dangerous situations, and they're worried for him. I said, okay, I'm not going to stop and Google, because I don't want to ruin. It had a great pattern going. The tension was good, and so I didn't want to spoil anything for myself, but I needed to know if he was okay. I know that I cannot continue watching until I know that he is alive. That, because as you said, it, you know, it's very emotional. You have very strong feelings for these people from the beginning. And if I'm going to find out like that he's killed during this investigation, I'm stopping right now. So I did stop. I cheated a little bit just to find out that Dan Schneider is still alive, and spoiler, he is still today. And, so then I was able to go on and finish watching the rest of it without Googling anymore.
It didn't even occur to me to Google, and I'm very much like a have the computer or the phone out while I'm watching something. Mm-hmm. And it never crossed my mind, because for some reason, like, the story seemed so new to me. And I was like, oh, this, I'm not even going to find anything. But of course I was going to find anything. This is such a bigger story than I, just because I didn't know about it doesn't mean the story wasn't huge somewhere else. But I found myself in that first episode, I couldn't read him. I was sort of thinking, is this a good guy or is this a bad guy? Especially when he says, I wanted to kill this person. You know, whenever he starts, you know, really considering taking the role of vigilante, you're like, uh-oh, what is this guy going to do? And then you realize that he is sort of this saintly person.
Yeah.
They don't play all their cards initially, which I thought was so smart of them, because it takes a full episode and maybe an episode and a half for you to realize that this guy is as good as you want him to be. you know?
It's true. And then there is that big twist. And that, I have to say, I think that's one of the all-time, as you said, it's a very, you know, tragic story in many different places. So you don't want to say it's like the best twist ever, but mm-hmm. it really is in a true crime docuseries where you can find out the whole story. If you just Google, you know, in 1 5-minute read, you could probably yeah. find out the whole story. It right. really was a great twist in that he had obviously a relationship with the person who turned out to be the killer. And I mean, it was almost kind of a father-son kind of relationship he yeah. had with the young man who turned out to be the person who killed his son.
Yeah.
And that I didn't see that coming.
No, me either. And I also didn't see the reveal of Dr. Cluggett coming. And I
yes.
that was the one and only time I actually gasped at the screen. And I'm not a big I guess I'm an occasional gasper, but it's more when I'm laughing. But
yeah.
the shock I felt, because there was no part of me assumed that she was going to appear on camera for this thing. And
oh,
I
yes.
and I also thought that she was either in prison or she had taken her own life or had died somehow. Like the way that they framed her or presented her was
yes.
almost in past tense. Like it was like, oh, don't even expect to see this woman because she's not available to us for any number of reasons. And when she's just mic'd and sitting in her chair in her house, I couldn't believe it.
That was definitely a gasp. That's the thing. Yeah. Again, this series had like so many big moments like that really did come out of nowhere, but also just how impactful they were for a story that you could have found out about by reading a newspaper article or, you know, yeah. something online. It was very well done. The pace was, you know, the pacing was great. The tension was great. I mean, as a storytelling example, it was a really great one.
Mm-hmm. And it did have a sense of closure at the end of it that yeah. a lot of these stories don't necessarily have. Like they'll present this terrible story and then you don't feel satisfied by the end of it, or you don't feel like the people have reached, I don't know, have reached closure. And this one definitely had that,
right.
which I was happy with. It reminded me of Making a Murderer, which I did not finish just because it was a little too long. And I worried
yeah.
that, and I knew from the beginning that there was no resolution.
Yeah.
I like this closed off, you know, tied with a bow at the end of its true crime. You know, not the unsolved true crime.
Me too. And I feel like this is a show that you could watch right now or in any sort of stressful time. And it would be, it's satisfying. And again, that seems like maybe a weird word to use to describe a show like this, a story like this. But it is satisfying because it does, I mean, it has several satisfying kind of endings at several mm-hmm. points of, you know, Dan Schneider keeps kind of reopening this story and turning it into a different story through all the things that he's trying to do. But each one of them does have a satisfying kind of wrap up. Whereas, as you said, Making a Murderer, I did finish the whole thing and was just crushed and heartbroken and still can't even really think about, especially for me, the nephew who is still
in prison.
God. Yes.
Yeah, it's
still crushing there. Oh, yeah.
That's a tougher sell for me.
Yeah.
But this one, it had, I feel like almost every episode, or at least the final three, had these inspirational moments and to varying degrees. And like the woman who testified against the murderer, who
yes.
sort of risked her life to go on the stand and then used that as a way to, you know, sort of go into recovery and change and turn her life around with the help of Dan and his family.
Right.
And I even liked the reveal that you think that Dan is alone and noticing this doctor running a pill mill. And when the DEA says, no, we've been on her for years, we've
right.
been doing this. It was it was comforting in a way to know that like certain aspects of the government are still sort of, you know, looking out for us, you know?
It was. No, it absolutely was. And then that all of that was part of this bigger picture thing, which is still in the news now mm-hmm. with Purdue Pharmaceutical. This guy, though, just... It's such a, I mean, it's a bunch of different stories. Obviously, it's a murder mm-hmm. story, and it's the story of this guy at this tiny little pharmacy in this, you know, little kind of suburb of New Orleans. And he turned himself into a private investigator. That was not his job in any way, but I was impressed by his investigative skills at several points and his bravery in just being able to put himself in any kind of situation and to talk to people and get them to talk to him and trust him. And that he just had these instincts about how to investigate and what to investigate and recording all those phone calls, you know, and just having all those instincts. He really was amazing. But I mean, I think at its core, it's really just a very, he's kind of a small town hero. It's like a cliche, almost a stereotype, but he really is that thing that if we saw it in a movie, a fictional movie, we'd kind of dismiss it as being too cliche. But because he is this guy who, you know, the only part, and I mean, this is always true of any hero story, that there's some part where you're, you know, you kind of can criticize him. He was putting himself in danger at a time when his wife and daughter had already lost
their son.
Yeah, they needed him more than ever. And, he clearly was driven. This was his way of dealing with the grief, the loss of his son in such a tragic way. And then in the middle, we haven't even mentioned, in the middle of all this, Katrina happens and they lose their house. I mean, all of these crazy, tragic things, any one of which a lot of people just wouldn't be able to come back from. Yeah. And he did and found these incredibly selfless ways of dealing with it that helped a ton of people. And as I understand it, when I did finally do the look up of where are they now after I watched the whole show, he's semi-retired now. He still occasionally works at that drugstore and has grandchildren. And so, you know, seems to be living the good life that I think anybody would agree he has earned.
To go back to Katrina, there was a moment, and sure, I mean, he obviously documented everything. That's that's part of the show. But there's a clip of his wife on a staircase during Katrina, and their house is utterly destroyed. And I don't remember that she's actually necessarily smiling, but there's a calmness. I don't know. There's like a grace to it that you sort of think like, oh my God, these people have gone through so much and they're handling this so well because they've lived this before, you know?
Exactly.
And like it's inspirational to see people, you know, going through times of adversity with, you know, their heads held high.
Definitely.
And I was finding myself maybe thinking like, oh, I feel like I might not have been this moved by the pharmacist if I weren't, you know, stuck inside the house in the middle of a quarantine, you know, but I was, and I am. So that's what happened.
You know, and as we're saying that, as you're saying all that, it kind of makes me think, wow, this is something I maybe would recommend. I should be recommending to people right now specifically because, it's hard to, I don't want to imagine people going through more than they went through because it's too much. But they were graceful and, you know, not only, they didn't just survive anything. They found a way to turn it into something that helped countless numbers of people. And again, it was part of, what has led to kind of this reckoning for Purdue.
It's a great story of perseverance that I think we could all use right now.
Absolutely. And so many great characters. As you said, I also really loved Shane, the woman who testified and had a chance to start her life over and move away from the circumstance she was in with her kids. And they are what you think of when people say, you know, good citizens, good members of their community. They were really helping as many other people as they could.
Mm-hmm. And to anyone who is like me and kind of worries about watching true crime that's going to leave them hanging, this is not one of those. This is not one of those documentaries.
No, it's great. It's very kind of self-contained. And if you want to read more about it, there are, you know, current things happening with the bigger issue of the opioid crisis and the epidemic and the company responsible for so much of that. But it is satisfying. It is a very satisfying 4-episode, which is great. Also, it's not a ton of time commitment if you think you can't, you know, making a murderer was, it did feel like just such a bigger commitment, not just
a season of television, right?
Right. But emotionally, it was a big commitment. And as you said, open-ended and still ongoing and kind of heartbreaking in a lot of ways. But this is, yeah, I think this is a good recommendation for right now.
I do too. And that was going to be my final question to you, whether or not you think it is. And I think we've both sort of realized through talking it out, it's a great one.
It is. I wouldn't have necessarily thought that before we we talked it out, but I think 2 thumbs up, 4 thumbs up.
Four thumbs up. We got 4 thumbs among us, between us. Well, thank you so much, Kim, for talking to me during these trying times.
Thank you.
You can all watch The Pharmacist now on Netflix. You can buy The Way We All Became the Brady Bunch anywhere you get books. Don't want to tell you where to do it. Just like, you know, get it because it's good. And thank you so much. And I'll talk to you later. Have a great week. Have a great month or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6.
Stop.
Bye, Kim.
Bye,
okay, I'll
thank
stop.
You so
Bye.
Much.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you.